Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the MidGame Assembly Interview Podcast. I'm Mr. MidGame, otherwise known as Matt Bambridge, and I'm joined today by Harrison.
Hello.
And Alex of Horizon MidGames.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good, good. Right, okay, so what we're here to talk about today is Monsterville Mansion, and like we do in these interview podcasts, we're going to go into a bit more detail. So we'll go straight into this one and go, right, Alex, what was the inspiration for writing Monsterville?
Cool. The game was a Halloween themed game, as you covered in the last episode, and really that was the inspiration. It was just before Halloween last year, so sort of 2018. I was in a very Halloweeny mood. I've watched lots of horror movies, and I was like, there's not been a lot of horror mega games. I should definitely make one of these. So, you know, I love Halloween. I love horror movies, and it was just right. I'm going to try and get all the cool ideas from this stuff and put it into a mega game.
Right, okie dokie. So what type of movies come into there? Because, you know, horror is a big genre. So what were you aiming for exactly?
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, that's a good point. My sort of, I guess, favoured horror movies are kind of ones with monsters, you know, whether that's sort of, you know, vampires, werewolves, all sorts of, you know, classic things to more sort of, you know, modern, esoteric, you know, Cthulhu-esque monsters and weird things like that as well. So it was kind of monster movies. And then I guess my other sort of favourite genre is the kind of classic kids in trouble kind of thing, you know, sort of cabin in the woods style thing, you know, that they're away in the wilderness and getting attacked by whatever creature that is after them.
Right, okie dokie. I think that we can agree is a fairly big pop culture reference in terms of those type of movies. So one thing I did want to cover, because Horizon Mega Games is slightly different to some of the other groups we cover, say Pet Nines, it's a conglomeration of people come together to run games. You run games as Horizon on a kind of more commercial bent. So was this designed to be popular or just because you love monsters?
I think, yeah, sort of probably the former with an eye on the latter sort of thing. So I guess all my games have been quite sort of pop culture influenced, or at least sort of nerdy pop culture anyway. And so I thought that's usually where I start something I love and enjoy, but that I guess that I think will attract people, that maybe there isn't that kind of mega game out there already. So some Mirror Shades is another good example. As far as I'm aware, there wasn't really a cyberpunk mega game. I felt that was a whole kind of area of sort of nerd pop culture that had an opportunity to make into a game, really. So it's the same idea with Monsterville, just something I felt was lacking that hopefully would attract people and that I like.
Yeah, okie dokie. And do you feel when you're picking games for Horizon that it's the kind of thing, do things that other people haven't done to carve that niche out? Or is it more just, I like this theme, let's have a go at that?
I think, again, a little bit of both, really. I think partly, especially if it's a game I'm designing, it has to be something you really love because of the amount of time and effort required. But when it's another designer's game, I'm probably more interested in, yeah, maybe in games that hasn't done so many of, whether is it a new idea or something a bit different. You know, I think there's plenty of people doing historic games, so you know, there's no point running more of those. Let's run stuff that other people aren't doing so much.
Yeah, okay, dokie. So thanks for that. So we'll move on and we'll talk a little bit about how you kind of think the game went, and we'll kind of break this down into sections. So in how do you think the human part of the game went?
So I think, you know, overall it was probably a mixed game. The human bit was definitely the strongest, and we'll probably talk about this a bit more later. But, you know, it was actually the area of the game I was most worried about. But coming into it, I felt it was the bit I'd least tested, least developed, that had the least stuff to do in it. So I was really concerned that they would, you know, find that they didn't have much to do, be a bit bored.
Yeah.
But yeah, it worked really well. I think people very easily got into that kind of, you know, college kids up to shenanigans kind of character. I know Becky talked in your previous episode a lot about what sort of things she got up to with the relationships and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think sort of the role-playing element of that really succeeded. Everyone got into their characters and that kind of gave them plenty to do and keep them entertained, despite the fact that mechanically it was actually, you know, relatively light for them. There was only a few things to actually do, so.
Yeah, okay, so I was at the game, but obviously I didn't see much of the human side of things, so I was over on the monsters. So when you were writing the human side of it, you kind of mentioned there that you spent less time on it. What were you intending for the humans to do, and what were they actually doing?
So I think everything that happened on the day and the way it actually worked was the design intention, which is probably partly why I never went back to it, because I sort of set up what I wanted them to do. I designed it. I was just concerned it was light, but really it was just, you know, to have this setup where it had all the kind of college kid life, so yeah, relationships, friendships, you know, kind of their own personal sort of desires, whether, you know, it was some were, yeah, to become a vampire, or some were just to, you know, be the most popular kid at school or whatever. But over that, give them this sort of horror movie sort of mission or whatever, which, you know, was to find out about the monsters, to explore the mansion, to survive till midnight, you know, and if possible, then defeat the evil. So, you know, I think all those elements worked and within the original intention. I just got a bit concerned before the day itself that maybe that wasn't enough.
Okay, dokie. And in terms of on the map, were they just exploring? Were they picking items up?
So yeah, it was similar to the Monster game in that respect. So they essentially went to a room. Their main driver was to sort of tag. They had to tag 10 rooms on each floor to sort of win this bet, which was why they're in the mansion in the first place. So they were that. They were spending their resource, which was called willpower, but it was essentially just a sort of generic economic resource. And they would sort of focus on tagging. But yeah, then there were other things they could do. They could try and collect some of the more monster resources, which they could use for trading and other things. They could find items. They could generally explore, find out secrets that of what the monsters were up to and that kind of stuff.
Cool. Okie dokie. So moving on to the press then, how do you think that one? Because they Tom and Ed seem to have a fair bit of a ball on that, and they were very funny up there doing their very teen high school radio show type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the results was beyond perfect, if you can have that. They did an amazing job. It was everything I imagined and more. You know, as you say, it was meant to be this kind of cheesy sort of internet stream of, you know, sort of haunted house investigators. And they did that. They did these amazing little skits and stuff. It was great. I think as players, they actually found that really hard and had to work really hard to do that. I think perhaps unlike in maybe a more political military game where there's a more reason for people to talk to the press, I think they found it quite a struggle for people to actually engage with the press. There wasn't much reason for them to do so. So I think they actually had to try really hard, which I think they found quite challenging. But I think the end result was really good. So I think maybe it's one of those things where, as a template, they got it absolutely perfect. Maybe I just need to make the player's job a little bit easier and not work quite so hard kind of thing. So maybe if there'd been a couple more novice players in those roles, they might have really struggled to make something of it. So just perhaps a few more reasons for people to actually talk to the press so they don't have to work so hard to come up with content kind of thing.
Yeah, okie dokie. Okie dokie, the third kind of group then is the monsters, which were split into all types of different kind. There were werewolves, mad scientists, witches, vampires, swamp creatures. I've probably forgotten a couple.
The cult and wraiths, if we didn't say that.
Yes, cult and wraiths. So how do you think that went?
I think this is probably the area of the game that worked less well than the humans, but for reasons I wasn't really expecting. So I think mechanically it worked pretty well. It was essentially a worker placement game for them with a little bit of area control, where essentially they put down their servants each turn, they built an economy engine, they expanded their holdings and then sort of powered them up to make the economy more efficient, which, you know, I worked really hard to get sort of balanced and functioning, and I think that worked really well. Certainly everything seemed to work on the day, and everyone said they got it and understood it, they knew what they were doing and worked. I think where that failed down, that was probably too involved for a mega game. It would probably have been really good for a board game, but it was a bit too involved for a mega game, where I think it took a lot of time, a lot of their effort. And so they didn't necessarily get too involved in the sort of narrative and role-playing elements as much as, say, the humans or maybe the press did. So I think it was kind of almost gave them too much to do, really, essentially.
Yeah, okay, okay. So that we're going to talk about the kind of the map and the mechanics a little bit later on. But overall, I do agree that on the day the mechanics themselves did seem to work kind of quite well. But monsters weren't quite getting involved in the roleplay side. Mm. And when you'd envisioned it, had you envisioned basically quite a light game with the monsters doing it as much as the freewheeling stuff as the humans?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, literally when I first sat down to write the initial sort of one-page design outline, the very first thing I said was a light mechanics game. And I managed to keep that in the human one, but then I think I got sucked into a sort of different design with the monster game, which, as I say, I've got quite pleased it worked from a mechanical point of view, just probably was a little too complex for a mega game, I think. Certainly a mega game with that kind of theme. Maybe if it had been a complicated military simulation, it might have been more appropriate.
Okay. So the last kind of major group then, the council, which was the each of the monster teams had a dark emissary to go along and talk to the Dark Lord. How did you find that?
Yes, I don't know. This is the one I'm least sure on. I think there were some mechanical issues in that it was the last part of the game I designed, and I think it probably didn't really get the attention or design effort it needed. It was a little bit rushed, and probably the idea of it being quite connected to the map game kind of drifted away a little bit. And I think probably more so as we actually went through the day, we kind of sort of let it drift into more sort of narrative structure. So I think I'd look to try and bring that back again in the future. That said, I don't know, some players found that quite frustrating. I think some other people on the council sort of had quite a fun day. I think Chrissy, who was playing the Dark Regent, sort of had sort of, some fun little sort of scenes with people. And I know Paul, who was playing the emissary from the cult, got this whole kind of rivalry thing going on with the Dark Regent. So I think in some ways, elements of the sort of the narrative and the politics work to a point, but probably needs a bit more refinement to kind of tie it up with the wider monster game.
Yeah, because we talked, that was part of the game I played, and I found it difficult to engage a bit, and I did find it difficult to see in some ways what effect it was having, because it was a fairly free-form voting, sliders moved up and down. You kind of mentioned when we talked after the game that you thought about heavier mechanics and cards that would interact with it, but you kind of took those out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was kind of, I'd played with a few different ways of doing it and how directly it would interfere with the map and, whether it would be more sort of a vote collection game, something along those lines where you had, kind of cards where you'd sort of collect votes and things. And ultimately it felt like it was almost too much because I'd put so much mechanics into the map game. The monster map game, it felt like, well, we'll keep this bit a bit light. But I think, again, it possibly went too far, and therefore there wasn't quite enough structure or tying up to the map game to keep it kind of coherent, I think. So I think slightly kind of repositioning the the interface between the Dark Regent, who's essentially a control role, and the players would probably work sort of a little bit less directly adversarial, and I think making the decisions seem a bit more concrete and have more of an effect, or at least seem a bit more important, I think, is probably what I'd look to do.
Yeah, okay. So we'll move on from that then on to playtesting. So how many times did you playtest this one?
So this was kind of a weird one. I think I probably did 3 or 4 playtests with groups of people, different sections of the game each time. Then we did the maps 2 or 3 times, and then we did sort of, there were these little challenge phases, which we haven't really talked about, but we sort of tested those a couple of times too. I also did a lot of essentially solo playtesting, where I was kind of balancing the monster map mechanics in particular, where essentially I'd just set up a draft version of the map and play through a bunch of turns. And obviously it couldn't, there's lots of different decisions to be made. You don't have the interaction of people, but I was just focused on making sure, what is the flow of the economy through the different parts of the game? Where do the resources go? Do you get something break down? Does anything not quite work? Which is something I hadn't done before. I'd sort of always tried to model that previously in like Excel spreadsheets and the sort of more sort of just an actual model, but I never felt it quite worked. I think both of my previous games had problems where the economy was never quite balanced. So I felt the easiest way to do this would actually just be sit and endlessly play through lots of different turns from just a pure mechanical economic point of view. And I think that actually helped balance it quite a lot, but it was very, very time consuming to do. So I'm not sure whether I'd do that again, or I'll go back to the models, I'm not sure, but it was an interesting way to test it.
Of course, that seems like an interesting way to do the playtesting rather than doing it on sheets. And I would say that absolutely kind of worked because the money did move through more smoothly than, say, something like Mirror Shades. But I feel that's probably because Mirror Shades has quite a bit more randomness in how you get money. You have to complete a run. There's obstacles that can come up. This one seemed to be a little bit more prone to min-maxing. Was that kind of deliberate or just something that kind of evolved from the style?
So it was an intention that you could build the perfect economy engine, you know, with the right stickers and the right rooms and the right actions. What wasn't an intention, it's probably the one thing that mechanically broke down the most on the day, was that the idea was each of the monster teams would busily screw each other over and actually break the other person's economy engine. As I mentioned earlier, there was this sort of challenge phase where you could move this mega spook, which was this kind of giant monster, each of the monsters around the map and cause trouble. The idea for that was that you would use it to strike at your opponents and take their rooms from them and therefore break their economy engine, break the optimization and force them to rebuild or change things. What actually happened due to a very minor design error was that it was slightly more efficient for players to place the mega spook in their own room because they got slightly more essentially victory points and so it was essentially safer, easier than it was to challenge against an opponent, which was in retrospect obvious when I was doing the designing and the sort of initial playtesting in that area. It seemed like that people would want to conflict, you know, they'd want to fight their opponents and damage them, you know. But I think it's this sort of human psychology whereby actually if you can get slightly more safer, even if the other option might be more fun and more exciting, but if it's a bit more risky, a bit more dangerous, you tend to go to the safe option. So that's what everyone did. So it meant that people's engines were not being challenged by the other teams.
Did the overlooking of that rule become apparent to you during the day, or did you find out about that after the game?
It was probably about halfway through the day that it became obvious that in the mega spook phase, when they were moving around, a lot of people were just leaving them in their own rooms. I probably could have made a ruling then to change it, but I decided to, that might be a bit unfair on some teams who had figured it out earlier than others and stuff like that. So It was, I left it. I think I would look to change it next time, though, to encourage further the kind of the conflict, really.
Yeah, that was basically going to be my follow-on question was, do you think it would have been better to try and fix it halfway through the game, or is that unfair to try and do that kind of ruling? Because it's a very difficult decision to have to make.
Yeah, I think generally the way I approach that kind of decision, if something's broken and actually isn't working and is stopping something functioning properly or being fun at all, I'd make a ruling and change it on the day. This wasn't really broken, it just was suboptimal, so I left it as it was. I think that was probably the fairer way to do it.
Yeah, it was an interesting one because playing as the vampire, to be honest, we kind of didn't spot that the entirety of the day, and probably in victory points pay for it quite a bit. But that may have been a thing where we got a nice process down for moving our engine around. So we're consistently hitting enemy rooms where I know people found that difficult. But yeah, not spotting that probably did, in terms of victory points, do us a bit over the day. But that comes back to, there's always going to be choices players make that are less optimal than others. So where do you try and deal with that as a designer? Basically, people will make suboptimal mistakes essentially in their movement.
I think that was it. It was kind of when I came at it, it was in the way that I think you guys approached it, where kind of, right, we could do something safe and boring, but get slightly more points. And it was only, you know, it's like 8 instead of 6 or 10 instead of 8. Something like that. So it wasn't a huge amount extra. You know, or we could get the slightly less points, but screw over our enemy and therefore, you know, longer term be stronger. And I thought that was quite an interesting game decision to make, either, you know, less points, but attack the enemy or stay safe and get more points. But it turns out that most people play it safe and just want to take that, you know, safety of the points, you know. So that was quite interesting. This is sort of designer, something to look at in the future. People often will play it safe if they can.
Yeah. Okay, so is there anything you'd change about the playtesting?
I don't know. I mean, you always want to do more playtesting. You know, I could have done more tests, more people, bigger, you know, get 20 people in a room rather than kind of half a dozen. But it's, you know, there's cost to that, both time, but also just in money oftentimes. So, you know, in an ideal world, you'd always do more. I think the probably the one bit I would look to, have, if it had been designed earlier, would probably have play tested the mechanics around the council more directly, because that wasn't really tested in any kind of meaningful way. So I think, you know, as always with testing, you want to do more and test every little bit, but it's just not as long as possible.
I know it's sort of trying to compare oranges and apples and all that, but comparing this to Mirror Shades and the amount of playtesting you did on those that game compared to this game, do you think you got a better playtest for one than the other? Do you think you playtested more than on one than the other?
Yeah, I mean, they were really different games. So Mirror Shades had less tests, but they were bigger because of the differences in the roles and the way things interacted there. So I think if the design supported it, I think lots of smaller tests is probably more useful than one or two big tests. But I think it's having the right tests for the game is probably more important than any particular method.
Yeah. Would you say your experience with the council would kind of make you more likely to not put an element into the game unless you'd had a chance to playtest it again?
That's a tough one. I think councils particularly. I think it's what the reason that I didn't maybe change it nearer the time, say, oh, this isn't quite ready, was the fact that it was something I thought could just be narrative driven. It could just be role play. And that's something you don't necessarily need to play test so much, you know, a bit like Elements of the Human Game that we talked about earlier, which, you know, again, didn't get a huge amount of testing, but they were very narrative focused, so that worked fine. I think probably it was more about time, and if I had, or even just sort of had thought through more about this needs a little bit more in the briefs, a little bit more narrative in the way that the Dark Regent's asking you to do stuff, so that ties in with the map and the overall story a bit more. So I think it was probably, I don't know if I'd always say it has to be all completely tested if it's narrative focused, but I think you do need to make sure you've thought through it all and worked out all the implications, which testing can usually help you do.
I think playtesting is a very interesting topic for conversation, because I feel like to a certain degree you can't fully playtest a game unless you get all the players in a room together and actually play the game. And I think it's almost like there are some aspects of it that aren't worth playtesting, because actually you might get like an unfair result from it or a negative result. And I feel like it's very difficult to know exactly how much playtesting to do, what to playtest, what scale to playtest it on. I think that could be a very interesting topic for a full conversation.
I'd completely agree. I mean, I think especially with the last couple of years in mega games, we're seeing a lot of new games from a lot of new designers. And often the first run of a game is not perfect. I think, you know, it's probably 80% of first runs of games have some degree of issues. That doesn't mean they're a disaster, but, you know, need some work before the second run. So I think, you know, and they're not that people aren't testing them. It's just that it is essentially impossible, unless you've got the 50 people, or unless you do a full dress rehearsal to test and make a game fully. So I think, yeah, that there's it's definitely worth a conversation. What do you do about that? Do we do testing a different way? Do we accept that, you know, first runs are essentially beta tests and, you know, market and price accordingly? I don't know, but I think, yeah, there's definitely an area there to talk about more.
Yeah, we should queue that one up, because it is, if we're going to accept the first runs of games basically aren't going to be as good, is it fair to charge people their full ticket price?
Yeah.
But that's not a question we're going to answer today. No. So we'll move on then to a little bit more into the mechanics. I know, Alex, is something you really wanted to talk about. So what was the original design intention for the map game?
So, yeah, I think it's sort of, you know, we touched on that right at the start, but, you know, the wording I'd put on my one pager was, you know, a light mechanical game. The idea being that, yeah, it was a very thematic, it was going to be very narrative, people running around as students and monsters. And then I think what happened is I kind of got stuck a little bit in sort of kind of a loop, I suppose, for a better word, of worried that people wouldn't have enough to do. I think probably the most common negative feedback to a mega game after it is, I felt my role was a bit light. I didn't have enough to do. I didn't feel like I was, you know, had something to engage in the game. You know, I think that gets mentioned way more than any other complaint. And so I kind of, you know, that was something I really wanted to avoid in this game, because it does come up so often, particularly on the monster side, where that was where the majority of players were. And I felt maybe the narrative was, you know, I think it's quite easy to pretend you're a jock or a cheerleader or whatever in a college. People understand that. But what exactly does it mean to be a wraith or a cultist or something? It's not so obvious. So I wanted to make sure there was lots of mechanics the monsters could play into if they wanted to. I think what happened was that probably I made them even more involved than they needed to be, and probably more mandatory than they needed to be. I think lots of mechanics and lots of things to engage with is great, but if you're really trying to get into the story and the narrative, it should be okay to leave them to some degree. You know, players want agency, they want power, they want things to do, they want to be engaged with the narrative. They don't necessarily want to be overloaded with kind of just lots and lots to do if they're more engaged on the other side.
Okay, so that's interesting. In terms of the narrative, was the map driving narrative? Did it feed in at all?
So yeah, I mean that was the intention. Both obviously it kind of gave the overall story of how each different monster factions were kind of how successful they were being, what resources they had, what control they had on the mansion. But there was also lots of kind of what I was hoping was little hooks that people could use to come up with their own ideas and stories. So it was something I kind of I did a lot of mirror shows with lots of little cards, lots of rooms, lots of stickers, whatever, with kind of little thematic descriptions on and a little bit of sort of background information, and then sort of hopefully that would sort of trigger ideas and thoughts, you know. So I don't know. So they one example that came from the game with the vampires, you know, they had a ballroom, so they kind of invited humans to their dance and all that kind of stuff. So that was sort of the idea, rather than sort of it being, you know, it was the kind of game that didn't really have one big story. It was lots of little stories, a lot of individual stories running through it. And so I kind of hoped that was what the map mechanics would drive, kind of thing, whilst also providing, you know, the sort of board gameplay for people to engage with as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because I didn't see that happening all that much. I would say that in terms of general mega games, I didn't see all that many Wizard Weezers coming out of the monsters. I know we kind of did the thing with the ballroom on the first turn, but not much after that. Do you think that was because the map looked very, very mechanical and there was some nice theming on the cards and the stickers that you put around, but there wasn't any individual briefings for each of the individual monsters or anything like that?
I think the individual briefings probably was more of a reason for that kind of stuff than the components and mechanics. Because I really don't think that different to Mirror Shades or something along those lines, or one of the other games. But I think maybe a few of the, or maybe the majority of the monster players, because they didn't have a personal brief, it was just a team brief with objectives, they didn't necessarily know where to go off from those kind of thing, which bits were more important. And there was definitely some of that. I mean, Nicole and a couple of the others did sort of play with some of their ideas and their brief, but it was less than I expected. I kind of had hoped that people would run with the idea of being, you know, a werewolf or whatever, and some of the kind of, the society and what werewolf society was that I kind of put into the brief was that they would sort of use that to come up with some ideas in conjunction with the cards and the runes and the stickers. You're right, I don't think that didn't happen as much as I expected. I think there's definitely some, but not as much. So I think that was possibly through personal briefs. People weren't sure quite how to drive that forward in a sort of objective way, maybe. Not sure. Want to think about more, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. It leads us into the next question that you kind of wanted to talk about, which was what was the design intention, how monsters would act and how they did actually act. Because I know the game was very much briefed as play your wacky monster, play your wacky human. And the humans definitely seemed to run away with that, as we spoke about. But with, I think, to be honest, notable exceptions in the monsters team, the monsters didn't. It just settled down into being a team game where you were trying to accumulate team victory points, by and large.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of fair summary of how it ended up. And I think some of the reasons, you know, we sort of touched on possibly the lack of personal briefs, the lack of inter-team conflict, maybe, did that to some degree. I think for me, the big surprise, and I don't know if this is a cause or a symptom, I'll be honest, but was that in my thinking of the way that the map turn went for the monsters was, you know, they had sort of, yeah, probably took two, three 4 minutes to do their thing each turn. But they would only be at the map for that bit, and they would just come and back. They would draw an initiative card at the start of the turn, so they knew roughly when they'd have to be at the map. If you drew number 7, you knew you had a good 10, 12 minutes to go and do other stuff. If you drew number 2, you could probably just hang away at the map, and then you'd have plenty of time afterwards. But actually, what actually did happen was players were just sitting at the map waiting for their turn, essentially, which was a real big surprise.
Do you think that's a lot to do with players, if they're at the map, want to know what the other teams are doing, that kind of locks you there? If you're, say, 5th in the turn order, if things move a bit more rapidly, you don't want to miss your turn. Is the very nature of having someone at a map going and doing mechanical things that can be affected by other people, is that going to mean that they do just get trapped at the map?
Yes, yeah, I think it can do. And that's kind of why I made the monster game very non-monster interactive. That's what, essentially, on a turn, two monsters couldn't really affect what the other monsters were doing. The only way to do that was with the mega spook. So that was the thinking being, you know, you just had to be there to do your bit and you go away, do the narrative. But yeah, I think you're right. I think people felt either they wanted to see or they should see. I don't know. So yeah, I think to sort of decouple the players from the map a little bit would be something I'd look to do next time.
So similar to my question about the things you saw happening with the rules, when did you see people hanging around the map during the game and think that's not what I was hoping people were doing? Or did you think maybe I'll try and kind of encourage them to go off and do their own thing? Or did you just want to just sit back and let them, you know, play how they've decided to play rather than how you pictured them playing?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a chaotic game with people everywhere because the room was probably just about big enough for the game. So it wasn't massively obvious until I talked to some of the map controls later and towards the end of the game, where, you know, you really start to understand where everyone is and what they're doing, that it became obvious, which by that point it was probably too late to do anything about it. So that was definitely more of a learning after for the future rather than for something that was picked up immediately.
Do you think if you had picked up on it immediately, you would have tried to do something about it, or would you have just kind of sat back and seen how it paired out?
Not sure. I don't know what I would have immediately done, because I think it's probably something that, yeah, maybe requires slightly more individual objectives to encourage the players to go off, slightly more reasons for the map players to kind of interact with each other or with the humans maybe. So I think it probably takes a little bit more rebalancing of the kind of narrative roleplay parts of the game than something you could probably do at the time, I think, probably. Mm.
Okay. So in terms of, obviously you wanted the monsters to act a bit more freeform, and you designed the map with the intention that you didn't need to be there all the time. Was there anything else in there to kind of encourage that freeformness, them going after each other, people trying to be vampires, or were you kind of relying just on essentially wizard reasons?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was relying on players to sort of engage with the character and the story. And I actually think that is the way the best mega games work, but I think it's quite an X factor to do it. So, I mean, I think in Monsterville Mansion, that did work perfectly for the humans. The humans didn't, their actual briefs were shorter than the monster brief by quite a bit of text. They had less objectives, they had less background. They also had less mechanics and less pieces to engage with. You know, they had less cards, they had less things to do. So I think there's quite an X factor. I think another example, you know, that we all talk about all the time is Den of Wolves, and probably one of the most successful games out there. And again, it's mechanically light. The briefs are real light. Most people don't even have personal briefs. Yeah, it always works. So I think it's really hard to identify how to get that sort of narrative engagement working in a mega game. I've certainly not cracked it. If someone has, I'd like to know. But yeah, I think there's a certain mystery to figuring that out still.
I think a massive element of it as well is the players. Like we've said before, that you can take the same mega game, run it every day of the week with different players, and it will come out completely different at the end of the day. And I think those kind of things where you're hoping for the players to pick up the narrative and run with it, or pick it up and move it in a different direction, and wizard wheeze and that kind of thing, is so dependent on the players, and even the players, how they're feeling that day. You know, if they're feeling like being creative, if they're feeling like just playing the brief, if they're feeling like being mischievous or helpful or anything, there's so many factors that can influence that.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I mean, I think as a designer, you can't rely on, you know, I want to have that sort of player on the day. You want to offer an experience that hopefully everyone can engage with and enjoy. So I think it's trying to identify the bits that do work in the games and the roles that where that works more often than not, and try and sort of roll that out as best you can. But yeah, I think it's a challenge. It's a tough piece of design.
Have you given much thought to how you'd make the monster game? Essentially, we have more interaction as the human game did in terms of that.
Not in depth. I'm sort of trying to bit of a distance from this game for a bit, partly because I probably won't be running it till at least the end of next year if I run it again. But I think part of it will be cutting down the complexity of the map game to give them just more space. And it might be even just a simple way. I think they had 5 servant tokens, so 5 things they could do each turn. Just cut that down to 3. Already it makes it's a much simpler kind of mental effort. In time, it's quicker and things like that. So that would be my first step. Personal briefs, definitely, I think, with some sort of probably inter-team objectives to some degree, which there was a little bit of where they were meant to be kind of battling to be the leader, but it just didn't work at all. And I think that was probably down to a whole bunch of reasons. So I think there'd be the 2 obvious things, but probably some more things I'll look to do as well that maybe tie in with the council game, probably, which is the other sort of narrative element that didn't quite click. So I'll probably look to really build those bits together.
So while we're talking about mechanics, were there any that you were particularly proud of that you thought worked really well on the day?
Oh god. So I guess overall I was happy that the monster sort of economy and mechanics worked. They might have been a bit too involving and sort of got in the way of the narrative, but I was that because they took a lot of effort. I was pleased they worked. And I guess the other thing, we haven't really talked that much about it, but a large part of the game was stickers, which you stuck on the map or stuck on cards you held. A lot of people really enjoyed that, the sort of making decisions about which stickers to buy, when, and you know, which ones to give up by putting your sticker over what you already had and stuff. So I thought it was a kind of that worked really well, because people seem to think that was really fun. So I might do that one again, another game in the future.
I think stickers are a very underutilized method of mega games that I would like to see used more. What was your final count on how many stickers you prepared for the game?
Oh, you know what? I never actually added it up. Of different types, there was probably about 40 different monster stickers off of the rooms, and probably about 20 for the cards, then probably about 20 for the humans. So there's probably about somewhere between, I don't know, 80 and 100 different types of sticker. But how many have I printed of each? Probably about 10 or 20. So I don't know how many that is. I mean, probably a couple of thousand at least, anyway.
a fair chunk of stickers,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah. But they're a lot easier to do than cards, because you just stick the sheet of stickers in the printer, hit print, and you're done. So it's much easier than doing cards. I have to cut them out and all that. So.
Yeah. I think there's something psychological as well about sticking a sticker on something. I think you think about it a lot harder. If you're buying a sticker to stick on like a character sheet or something,
yeah,
you really agonize over that decision before you do it. I think it's an interesting psychology.
Definitely. No, I think it's definitely something I enjoyed.
Well, it makes a change from having 3,000 or 4,000 cards like Mirror.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A lot easier.
So right on something slightly different then, which is something I know you wanted to talk about, Alex, which was the effect of designing mega games on the designer's life.
Yes.
you've been through this a couple of times now. I am just beginning to find out the terrors of it myself. So yeah, so what's it like on your time?
It ruins your life and no one do it. So I've done 3 games in 3 years and I'm now taking a break. So I think that probably says all of it. But yeah, I think it's, I think what I wanted to talk about really was that it is such a small hobby. We're all still doing this essentially as a hobby, even if, you know, some people sort of like myself trying to look at it as a more commercial way. There's no way anyone's making any money from it yet. So everyone is doing this as a hobby. And it's the amount of effort and time it does take to design a game. I mean, it's something we've talked about occasionally, but I think 100 hours is the minimum for a simple game. I think 200 is closer to what I've spent on all my games. You know, that is a... Even over a year, that's a fairly big chunk of your free time. It's, you know, 3 or 4 hours a week. That is a big commitment of time. Like in any project, it tends to get bunched up in the sort of 3-4 months before the game, you know. So I think it's an intense, hard thing to do. Whilst I would encourage everyone to do it, if I need to have more games to run and play, but it's also something that I think, you know, as a community, we should really, just be aware of that designers put a lot of time and effort into building a game.
So I suppose this leads to the natural question. Do you as a designer feel appreciated for the time you put in, or do you not feel appreciated essentially? Because it seems where that type of kind of comment comes from is, are we as players, and I'm probably as guilty as others, are we showing you enough appreciation?
I think appreciate, I mean, I don't think anyone wants to be put on a pedestal, and, you know, I'm probably as a player, you know, I design way less than I play or control, so I think I'm as guilty of anyone. But I think what perhaps we could do as a community is try and be a bit more constructive in our feedback, a little bit supportive when things maybe don't work out so well. And this is, you know, I don't think anyone's awful or horrible, but I think we do it as a community, and I am absolutely as guilty of this as anyone, tend to always pick on the negatives of a game. And I think maybe we can think about more being constructive in our feedback sometimes.
Yeah. And how would you kind of suggest to obviously kind of feedback forms go around at the end of the game? And obviously the end of a game is quite often when you can get quite a lot of false positives on, as we've talked about before, false positives on those feedback sheets. Because if someone has had a few bad experiences in the day, especially towards the end of the day, that is going to prejudice what they put down. If they've actually had a great day, but the mechanics of the game weren't actually all that great, can they overrate the game? Because I know personally that's happened to me. I went to a game where the mechanics weren't great, but I ended up having a good day, but a lot of people didn't. And so that influenced my feedback. So how would you try and collect that feedback in a more constructive way?
I think the sort of post-game feedback can probably be over-positive or over-negative. I think you kind of post-game, you're probably quite emotional, quite kind of heightened responses. So I think it tends to two extremes. You rarely get people who are kind of, yeah, it was all right, kind of had an okay day. It tends to either be, yeah, the negatives are really amplified or the positives are. So I think, I don't think there's necessarily a problem collecting that, but I think there's definitely sort of a filter that almost needs to be applied 2 or 3 days later, where you can actually probably get the more concrete feedback of, this is the mechanics I quite liked, these are the mechanics I didn't like, whatever it might be. I think that's where the useful stuff comes, rather than in the pub afterwards. Particularly, I think for a designer or even, you know, if you've just done control or as a player, you know, you're pretty tired. You don't necessarily take it all in. It can be quite overwhelming. So I think, you know, the initial post game feedback's good. It's good to hear that, to get people's emotional responses. I think that's important. But I think the really useful detailed stuff probably comes the next day or 2 or 3 days later, kind of thing. And you want to try and collect that.
So you would value, say, for example, if someone came along and either had a really great experience and wanted to tell you about one mechanic they really enjoyed, or had an experience where they felt like a mechanic didn't work, you would find more value in, say, like an email sent a couple of days later, or WhatsApp message or Facebook message or whatever. Then do you think that's a bit more useful to you as a designer, or do you find yourself kind of reading those feedback forms and thinking, well, was that actually a heightened reaction, either positive or negative?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think at the time it's good to get an immediate yes, you know, sort of, yeah, good, yeah, no, bad sort of thing. I think it's nice to get that, just because you kind of get a feel from people, and, you know, a definite portion of people are never going to bother emailing or filling in something afterwards. They're going to go home and go on with their life. So I think it's good to just talk to everyone afterwards and get their short little kind of nuggets back, but probably detailed mechanical feedback, structural stuff, you know, real that DM stuff, yeah, it's probably better in an email or something 2 or 3 days later. I think that's a much more useful time to get it.
Yeah, and for everyone listening, we would absolutely encourage that, although I'm terrible at doing it myself, but I would absolutely encourage people to do that. Okay. Is there anything else you wanted to mention on the kind of topic of effect on designers' life, Alex?
No, I mean, I think, yeah, I'd say I think it's a real major undertaking doing a mega game, but I think it can be super satisfying as well. I think when you see your own game run that you've put hundreds of hours into, it can be really satisfying. I think it can also, it can be frustrating. It can be difficult, but, you know, joking aside, it's a lot of hard work, but it is very rewarding. And yeah, I'd, if you're thinking about it, give it a go. But just don't underestimate the amount of effort and time it will take. But if you've got the time and willing to do it, go for it, I think.
I was going to say, like, I'm not foolish enough or secure enough to design a mega game myself, but I can imagine that the lows are very low, but I can imagine the highs are very good as well. I don't know if you've had a particular moment in a mega game. So, you know, just plucking one out of thin air, like when I beat Matt in that election in Mirror Shades 1, just as a random example.
I don't know if you had, thanks, Harrison.
If you had a particular moment that really, you know, kind of like you cling on to that vision of something happening in those darkest hours and you think about like a highlight that really brings you through.
Yeah, like that time I blew Harrison up in a police building live on air.
That wasn't one of Alex's games, Matt. We're talking about Alex tonight.
But yeah, no, it's exactly that. It's the stories. It can often come days or weeks after the game where people are still talking about things they did in your game, in your world. You know, that's really, really satisfying. Or I think with my first game, Crows in Elysium, you know, Johan's gone and run that in Sweden a few times now, and just seeing the world I create and the game I created played by people aside from Johan and a couple others I've never even met, you know, it's that's a really satisfying feeling. You know?
Yeah, that must be very cool. That must be very cool indeed. I'm still not going to design one anytime soon, but that must be very cool.
Okay, okay. Well, I think that's everything for today. Alex, is there anything you want to say?
No, other than, you know, if you want to check out Horizon Mega Games, we're on Facebook and also horizonmegagames.com. Got a whole bunch of games coming up. Well, there's one Saturday, that's the last one for this year, but then a whole bunch of next year as well. So.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for that, Alex. So, this was the Mega Game Assembly interview podcast. Check out our other podcast where Harrison does a monthly wrap-up of what happened, and I do one of these every month. Head over to the Facebook page and head over to megagameassembly.com to look at calendar of all the games in the world, kind of free mega games up there, resources, blog, podcast, all of that style of thing. So, thank you very much, Alex.
Cool. No worries. No, thank you.